We move on to our next exciting presentation by Dr. Craig Browdy. He is going to talk on novel and emerging technologies. Can they contribute to improving aquaculture sustainability? May I introduce Dr. Craig Browdy? He is the past president of the World Aquaculture Society and served as the assistant director of SCDNR Marine Resources Research Institute, leading the aquaculture sections, Weddell Marine Research and Development Center. His research over the past 25 years has targeted aquaculture technology innovation to improve availability and of seafood resources, specifically focusing on financial and environmental sustainability. He has developed collaborations and consultancies in several countries in Asia, Latin America, and the Middle East. Dr. Browdy is now the Senior Manager for Aquaculture Research for NOVUS International Incorporated, a global leader in animal nutrition and health applications. Dr. Browdy, the floor is yours.
In following Sena's model, I've been vigorously negotiating at the back of the room for a few extra minutes for my talk, so I hope that I'll be able to get in some interesting insights into novel and emerging technologies. Certainly not the one who's put together this talk or this certainly the paper that went along with it. I had a lot of input from a number of contributing authors and also input from this book called New Technologies in Aquaculture, which I highly recommend for some light reading. If anyone is interested, it's about this thick, but it has a fantastic, fantastic wealth of information from put together by Gavin Bernal and Jeff Allen. So what are our challenges? Well, we've heard it over and over again. We've got to feed people. We've got to support socioeconomic development. We've got to deal with environmental responsibility. And I think it's very important that we don't forget the bottom line, which is profitability, because I think a lot of the advances that we've seen in the last 10 years have been driven by a profit motive. So if we make sure that that stays in our definition of sustainability and certainly coming from the private sector at this point, we can see that the way that technologies move in have to do also with profitability. But the question is, can we have our cake and eat it too, as we say in the United States? Can we have win-win solutions where you can actually achieve sustainability and at the same time improve profitability? And I start with these two quotes to keep in mind. Necessity is the mother of invention, and innovation distinguishes between a leader and a follower. So there's a couple different areas I want to try and go through during this talk, a little bit about genetics, health, nutrition, then get into a few minutes about production systems, and end up with a few words about information and communications technology. So in each of these areas, I'd like to try to focus on where the innovations are coming from and where we stand today and have to look for the next few years. In terms of genetics, we need to look no further than poultry to see what the opportunities are. You can see that breeding, it's been estimated, accounts for 85 to 90% of the change in broiler growth rate from 57 to 2001. It's a paper by Havenstein. And if you look at these bars, it makes it very clear to see these are the unselected controls versus the selected. The difference between the blue and the red can be attributed to differences in diets using an old diet from 1957 versus one from 2001. Working for a company like NOVUS, we see it very clearly from all my colleagues in the poultry industry. And the question is, how can we take some of these ideas and advances and move them to aquaculture? Unfortunately, in aquaculture, less than 20% of aquaculture production comes from selective breeding programs. But there are some good examples out there, and it's a doable thing that's been done over and over again. The key is to do it right. It's been said before that we need to pick our species. We need to decide which species we want to work on. These breeding programs are extremely resource intensive, and so we have to limit the number of species that we choose to the most important. Then close the life cycle in captivity, and most importantly, we have to control the founder stocks and pay very close attention to elimination of excludable pathogens and control of pathogens in breeding stocks. If we don't do that, you may as well not start. So we've developed this model with a white shrimp, for example, with biosecure breeding centers and using selection strategies that maximize improvement. These are examples of some of the selective breeding programs that are out there today from Gidi Hulata's paper in the New Technologies book. And here's the different kinds of traits that are being selected for, looking at growth being the major one, but making some good advances in things like disease resistance and other important traits, including reproduction. Transgenics has been in the news lately. Technically, in terms of the science and the innovation, there's a number of techniques of getting genes into fish. We've seen genes being transferred into a number of species successfully. We've seen a pretty big significant difference in growth rates and some good results with the productivity of transgenic fish. The problem, of course, has to do more with the issues and the risks, and how do we deal with those issues and risks as a culture, as a society. And the environmental, food safety, regulatory, and animal welfare risks are very serious. And just in these last few days, we've heard a lot about the United States Food and Drug Administration looking to say whether or not, you know, is it safe to eat a fish that has a growth hormone from another fish inserted in its genome. And Ann Kapuscinski and her group have been working on this for a long time to develop models for risk assessment. She has a very good book on this and summarizes it here. It'd be interesting to see, you know, how she feels about the FDA, whether or not, you know, you can really safe to eat a fish with a foreign gene in it. In terms of genetics, the big area of there's been a lot of advancement is genomic enablement. I mean, basically, the any kind of stimulus, be it physiological or environmental, goes through the genome in order to generate some sort of a response in the animal. And lately, we've been made great advances in gene discovery, in understanding the expression of genes, and in things like marker-assisted selection. For example, there are more and more libraries being made of genes of aquaculturally important species. We can learn an awful lot just sequencing RNA and finding out what messages these fish are turning on and turning off. For example, just creating a library tells you a lot about what a certain tissue, for example, what its role is and how it achieves that role. This is some work that we did with white shrimp, for example. And nowadays, there's higher and higher throughput transcriptome sequencing, so we can generate ESTs, express sequences, and RNA faster and faster. This is leading along the road towards whole genome sequencing for a number of aquaculture species. So once you've got these genetic libraries, then you can take this stimulus response model and look at something like gene expression and try and understand by using tools like microarrays. First of all, you can identify up and down regulated genes, which leads to mechanistic science, or you can use the transcriptome as a classifier and understand whether a fish is under stress or what kind of stresses are acting upon an animal in the environment, things like echogenomics. So there's microarrays that are being developed for a number of different species, and they're getting bigger and bigger and more genes. So this can lead to hypothesis-based science. This is one example for some work that we did in Charleston on shrimp, where we were looking at the effect of a virus on a shrimp, and we wanted to try and understand, you know, what kind of changes there are in the genome of the shrimp and the expression after infection with white spot syndrome virus. And the way that we did that was to build a microarray and to look at which genes are up and down regulated. And they ended up with a lot of different ideas about different types of genes that changed, and it led to a lot of different mechanistic science that's still out there to be followed up on. Also in genomic enablement, there's a lot of work being done on marker technologies faster and faster. We now have these different types of markers that can be developed much quicker with these pyrosequencing and new technologies. And they have great uses in aquaculture, for example, in analysis of population structure and so on, especially for things like stock enhancement, for example, tracking what happens to the fish that you release. And nowadays, we're developing linkage maps with these markers for more and more aquaculture species. So this is something we can look forward to in the next 10 years. I think when we come back 10 years from now, we'll have physical maps for most of the major important species, and that will allow us to do things like this. Here's an example of a gene that was found for resistance to an important lymphocystis disease. It was a single a locus. They were able to breed a homozygous female with the resistance gene with commercial strain of males and get all resistant progeny. So these are the kinds of things we can look forward to in the future. The challenge is that we have so many species we're working with, the costs and the logistics. Biosecurity is always a challenge with genetic programs. Bioinformatics is probably going to be the biggest one. And how are we going to afford to be able to deal with all this information? Let me move on to health for a few minutes. Diagnostic technologies, there's tremendous advances going on in the field in the last 10 years. New molecular and serological diagnostic techniques. We don't need necessarily to have expensive PCR machines in order to diagnose things, but now that we can use these new loop-mediated isothermal amplification LAMP techniques to do it basically at room temperature and in a very simple laboratory with simple tools. So new diagnostic technologies are being developed. One of the most important areas of advancement, understanding pathogen-host interactions, as was talked about earlier today. We need to understand more about pathogen biology and host defenses and immunology and these immunomodulatory relationships, as Patrick said. And I promise I didn't look at his notes and he didn't look at mine. But I think that this is really important to figuring out the epidemiology and spread of disease. So how do we achieve disease control? I think, again, you know, we can't just look at technologies like diagnostics and so on as magic bullets. We need to take an integrated approach. We need to look at regulatory issues. We need to look at things like site selection and not overburdening an area. Systems design, things like fallowing. Put that together with nutritional technologies that are being developed that I'll talk about in a little while, different types of things to improve the health of the gut of the animal and the health of the animal as a whole. And combine that with these genetically improved stocks, specific pathogen resistance, perhaps resistant to diseases, and new ideas like vaccines and therapeutics. And when you put all that together into a holistic approach, the disease control problem is much more manageable. These are some examples of some of the advancements that are being made in vaccine technology. And again, I think over the next 10 years, we're going to see more of that. Chemotherapeutics, I'm not as optimistic. Unfortunately, it costs so much to develop an effective chemotherapeutic and get it registered that the market size just doesn't pretty much allow for it. But there are some new ideas and new technologies and better ways to use the chemotherapeutics that are being developed by livestock industries and other areas. New technologies like gene silencing in shrimp can absolutely block viral disease. I think that somewhere along the line in the next 10 years, some of that's going to come into fruition commercially. And I put up this diagram by Christine Sommerfeld from the New Technologies book as an example of controlling pests like sea lice and salmon and how you can take this integrated approach and look at it as a holistic problem and a holistic solution. There's a lot more detail in the paper, so I'm sort of brushing through to show you the broad brushstrokes, and we can come back to details as necessary. When we talk about nutrition, I think the bottom line in terms of the overall fundamental recommendation is that we need to improve our formulation strategies and base it not on the things that we have available to feed with, but the nutrient availability and nutrient requirements of the species. And this is typically being done now with other livestock species. We need to do it with our aquaculture species. We need to formulate based on ingredient digestibility, on nutrient utilization, and on species specific requirements, and you don't see a lot of people formulating for nutrients. Unfortunately, a lot of our information that we need is information on the digestibility of the ingredients so that we can do that. And we need to use more technology like near-infrared spectroscopy to look at the quality and how our ingredients change over time. There are some opportunities for improving feed production technologies that are moving into the field. And as was talked about a little bit earlier, functional feeds offer great opportunities for the future in terms of coming in with finishing diets to be able to change the fish that we're eating, or certain additives that we can use in feed during stressful points in time during the cycle in order to strengthen the fish to avoid disease. I'm not going to talk a lot about the fish meal and fish oil, as we're going to talk about that next time. Simple facts, we have to go to other alternatives. But we have to move on to the next question, as was said by the original panel, and that is, how do we deal with and how do we sort through these alternative ingredients? A lot of these land-based alternative ingredients have certain problems that go with them, anti-nutritional factors, non-digestible compounds, issues with palatability, issues with missing essential amino acids or specific highly unsaturated fatty acids that you really can only get from fish oil. So what we need to do is to start addressing these things and to setting them up as priorities and how we're going to deal with each one of them. And there are ways of dealing with them. There are ways of improving alternative ingredients. We can improve the nutrient availabilities, for example, using things like enzymes and pretreatment and breeding of plants to reduce non-digestible carbohydrates. Protein concentrates is a good example if we could only get the cost in line. Phytase, microbial enzymes, supplementary amino acids are used typically for livestock production and poultry production, and it's going to work its way into aquaculture. Palatants and attractants and getting the functional ingredients out of the fish meal, I think, are the answers as we move forward. And then we need to be innovative and look at new ideas and new products like microbial proteins, this very interesting company that takes waste from a brewery and turns it into a microbial bioflock that can be fed directly into the fish feeds. Those kinds of innovative solutions are going to come more and more online. And oils, of course, we talk so much about protein, but we can't forget about the oils. We have right now algal-based sources of DHA, for example, and ARA, and from other sources that have been demonstrated to work very well in aquaculture feeds. The only problem right now is the cost, but I think that over time those costs will come down as patents begin to expire and as other people begin to work on other technologies to bring in these oils online. But right now we have tremendous opportunities to increase our efficiency just by blending in the other oils for the energy use and only providing the fish oils for the highly unsaturated fatty acids as needed, and only during certain stages of the life cycle. Okay, a couple words about production systems. I guess if there's nothing else you take from this presentation and nothing else that I provide in this lecture, I just would hope that there would be some take-home message from this particular slide. I think that in order to achieve the goals that we want to achieve in the next 10 years, it's not enough to say, as we say in the declaration, that we want to have continued technology development to support the solving the problems that we have. It's not enough to say that we need to have continued innovation and we need to provide money for the scientists to play in their laboratories. I think that if we want to truly be efficient and we really want to move forward towards goals, it's very important that in terms of technology and innovation that we build a consensus on what those goals are. And once there's a consensus on the goals, and they can be anything. I mean, they could be from productivity and financial sustainability and profitability to something like better socioeconomic results, better food security. But we need to decide what the goals are. And then there's a second very critical step, which I think was perfectly demonstrated in Barry's talk that he said a few minutes ago, and that is to develop the quantitative criteria and metrics that we need to achieve that goal. The Wright brothers would never have been able to get their airplane off the ground if they had not figured out how to measure the lift capacity of the wing designs that they were testing. Once they knew what to measure, then they were able to build the whole airplane. So what we need to do is to determine what kinds of indices are most important in order to achieve the goals that we want to achieve. And then we have to put the scientists' feet to the fire in order to show that their research is moving those metrics forward in the direction that we want to move. And these are some examples of some of the metrics, and I think there was a lot of them given in the previous talk. So when it comes to cage production of marine finfish, land-based recirculating systems for marine finfish, coastal shellfish production, and land-based shrimp production, we put together a workshop a few years ago to look at these, how to push these things forward in terms of profitable aquaculture in the United States. And the goal of the workshop, a few hundred of us got together and broke into breakout groups, was to identify where the technology gaps are and what measurements need to be made, what kinds of indices can be developed in order to see whether we can move forward towards filling those gaps and achieving those things. So this is also free. Download that website. And in terms of these production systems, I would welcome you to take a look and see the kinds of things that were identified and how we identified moving forward on them. I thank Peter Edwards. He doesn't know it, but I used his chapter in the traditional aquaculture, aquaculture technology book, to look at the traditional aquaculture systems. And I think he did a really nice job of talking about small-scale aquaculture systems and how most of these technologies that I've been talking about have been developed for large-scale industrial aquaculture. The question is, how can we take some of these things that are coming out of that and move them into traditional small-scale aquaculture? I think Rohana also did a very nice summary of this for a recent FAO workshop. And it's not hard to do. It's not impossible. There's opportunities to use genetically selected socks. There's opportunities, as Peter was saying, to improve more efficient fertilization and water quality management to improve traditional aquaculture. There's opportunities in terms of feed formulations, not expensive feeds that use a lot of protein, but we can certainly, even when you use bioflock systems and systems like that, you have to have formulated feeds in order to make the animal perform optimally. But the bottom line is, and I think it's been said here several times, I'll just echo it again, that there has to be some organization of these small-scale traditional aquaculture systems of the sector so that they're large enough to be able to use some of these technologies, like diagnostic technologies and so forth, so that they have a basis for the seed production of a higher quality seeds. So I think when we focus the results of this particular conference, we don't just say that we want to increase traditional aquaculture systems. I think we need to be more specific and talk about the size that's really necessary in order for something to be self-sustaining, in order to take care of the whole life cycle of the product, and for there to be the backup there that they need in terms of technologies. Integrated multitrophic aquaculture, there's been a lot of discussion of IMTA systems here, so I guess I won't jump on the bandwagon except for that it's so so important that I think it bears a little bit of mention again. These are ecologically based approaches where the nutrient waste from one fed species can be used to feed grazers, filter feeders, or primary producers. So you have to engineer the use of additional trophic levels, and that takes a lot of innovation and a lot of science and a lot of expertise, and you got to get the bivalve guys together with the finfish guys so that they can work together, because the finfish guy is never going to be able to grow bivalves, and the bivalves guy is never going to be able to grow finfish. So that's the complication, and that's one of the things we have to get over. But the key is to add value and to make it profitable, because then it'll drive itself. This I borrowed from my colleague Muki Spiegel, of some of the work that they've been doing in Israel on this since I got there in 1981 to start my PhD. They were already working on this stuff. It was using the shrimp and the fish and the waste to grow microalgae, macroalgae, or constructed wetlands and land-based systems, and then filter back the water into filter feeders, detritivores, and then use the macroalgae for herbivores and constructed wetlands just to sell. And then there's also examples, this from Terry Chopin on the IMTA site in New Brunswick, where you have the salmon cages and next to them the mussels and the seaweeds. And I think we saw this morning in Patrick's talk that this really is something that was observed from what's going on naturally as a development in China, and that's now trying to engineer it in Canada. A lot of talk about bioflock technology. I worked on bioflock technology for a long time with shrimp and got to very high production levels and very high reuse. And bioflock's great for maintaining water quality, et cetera. One of the problems with bioflock is, you know, you really have to aerate a lot. It's got to be oxygenated in order for the bioflock technology to work, which has a cost in and of itself. So there's really no free lunch. But if there is an example of a win-win situation, perhaps bioflock technology is it. Because here, you know, you get more profitability because you have to put less stuff into the feed. The animal grows more on the bioflocks. You have less problems with less cost of pumping and discharging waste into the environment, in situ cycling of the waste. So you have the opportunity and the sustainability, and at the same time you have the increased profitability. And this is why this has been taken up and used more and more in different places in the world. A lot of science still remains to be done, taking it apart and figuring out, you know, what do we have to put into it, how the different members of the microbial community are working and are working together, and how do we manage that black box and push it in one direction or another direction, and which direction do we want to push it in order to make the system the most productive or in order to make to replace the most feed. These are the kinds of questions we have to ask, and then once we have the indicators, then we have to move towards those solutions. Information and communications technology is perhaps the area where things are moving fastest over the last 10 years. It's incredible, the changes just since 2000. We're getting the whiz-bang stuff coming out, the monitoring, control, and automation in these high-intensity salmon systems, for example. And one place where it's really paid off is in terms of risk management and the preventing the loss of catastrophic losses. That's pretty much doable today using these technologies. We're getting better at things like controlling water quality. And one place where this can really help is in feeding efficiencies. If there's anything that we can gain on, it's we waste so much right now in the way that we grow animals. And we can improve efficiencies using technologies, then that'll be a big payoff and a payoff for sustainability. That should be some place that we put our efforts in the short term. There's opportunities here with business enterprise planning and management. Quality and traceability, if you read the chapter again in the New Technologies book, he's got a great section on how we can use technology to trace the animals from the farm to the store and make sure that they were kept in good conditions from the time they came out of the water to the time they get to the plate. And this is something I think we're going to see more of in the next 10 years in some place where aquaculture has a true advantage that we don't take enough we can take more opportunities from. And finally, the Internet. The Internet is just becoming so pervasive, and that can work into our favor. And I think the most important way that can work into our favor is education and extension and getting the word out, particularly to small farmers, so that we can take some of these technological advances that are being used in shrimp farms and salmon farms and monoculture and operations and take the kernels and the grains that we can apply and then apply them into traditional aquaculture systems and improve access to information. So a few conclusions. I think that the pace of technology development is increasing all the time. We have tremendous advantages in genetics and nutrition, health, systems engineering, and information technology, and all of these have had profound effects on aquaculture within the last 10 years. But we have a huge goal to meet, and we have a lot of work to do in the next 10 years rolling up our sleeves. So the key is, how can we take these innovations in sustainability and productivity, even though they've been implemented in most cases for large-scale industrial production systems, we can continue to do that, continue to crank out food for people. On the other hand, we have to be able to also use some of these in more traditional systems. There's a lot of examples in the talk I just gave and in the paper that goes with it of win-win improvements in sustainability and profitability. And these are the things that just sort of roll like a ball going downhill. And these are the things that we need to strive for. I think it's important when we come out of this conference that we, as a recommendation, that we build consensus and goals on where the technology gaps that we want to fill are, which are the most important, and which measurement indices we can use to focus and measure progress in achieving those goals. We can't just throw money at the scientists without going back and making sure that we're making progress towards a goal. So we have to have outputs for the investments in technology development. We need to increase the development of technologies that are applicable for small and medium-scale systems. And that's not being done enough, and it's not and we have to not only develop technologies but apply existing technologies to medium and small-scale systems and extend the availability of existing know-how and technologies for them using things like the Internet. We need to be able to disseminate this information not to each individual farmer with one small pond, but to be able to get farmers together into the little bit larger units, cooperatives. And I think that we also need to focus on medium-scale entrepreneurs, take the best farmers and encourage them to be entrepreneurs and to grow to that next level, which will support the whole life cycle of the product, which will support being able to produce the feeds and being able to produce the seed, and which will support being able to produce the food that's so badly needed in the jobs. So I end with this quote. If you open up the mind, the opportunity to address both profits and social conditions are limitless. It's just a process of innovation. Thanks.
May I invite Dr. Patrick Sarkulas, Dr. Jeff Allen,
Dr. Patrick Sarkulash?
Dr. Kevin Fitzsimmons? Dr. Jay Parsons? Dr. Lathan Liu? Dr. Johan Verrett? Dr. Johan Verrett?
Amara by public demand again?
And Dr. Liu Johnson? Justin? That was another excellent presentation. Excellent presentation from Dr. Brody. And you have a distinguished panel before you. And as I said before, the most important thing is to have responses and reflections on what was presented so that we have a good series of recommendations for the organizers and also for the final declaration from Phuket. So I open the floor for discussions. A lot of new technologies were put, a lot of doable, a lot of enabling technologies, a lot of advancements were presented in a very short period of time and very nicely presented, and I think there must be a lot more questions. Otherwise, I'll ask one by one. Yes, please. So please state your name and affiliation, please.
Thank you. I am from Indonesia. I work at the Hasanuddin University, Department of Aquaculture. So before I give explanation, I would like to appreciate for most of the panel here, especially to Dr. Brody, to give the very, very interesting and exciting title. So I would like to talk about the shrimp immunity, especially in tiger shrimp and white shrimp, what you call it, the Lithopenaeus panamei. So we had problem in Indonesia so many, many years ago this about the disease, especially the virus disease, and this is give us the very, very, what you call it, the give the impact of our shrimp production become very, very low. And the people will now will try to use, what you call it, something, research application, which try to mix culture with shrimp and white shrimp, shrimp and tilapia. So they have something like production, high production. Maybe something result from this. This is, we know that tilapia is, this is something we call they produce accretion, and then the, maybe it is impact on the virus, or I don't know. So what is your comment about shrimp immunity until now? So until now, maybe we don't have vaccine special for shrimp, because shrimp is, we call it, unpredictable. That's it's different from fish. For fish is okay. We have.
Okay, your question is about.
My question is, how do you think about it for next future to eliminate this problem? Thank you.
Yeah, the question is, I guess, relating to whether we have more understanding of shrimp immunity to help us with shrimp diseases, and whether or not polyculture could be part of a solution. I think the short answer would be yes. The longer answer would be that, polyculture offers opportunities that haven't been completely looked at yet. One of the problems, of course, is the tilapia eating the expensive shrimp food. But if you can get past that, it could be a pretty good option in terms of weeding out some of the weaker animals and so on. But in terms of the immune system of the shrimp and where we've gotten with all of this fundamental research, I think that what I've gotten is much more respect for the immune system of an invertebrate, even without any antibodies and without a specific immune system. I think that there's an immune system there, and that it works, and that it's important, and that there's opportunities to use it. The trick is just to keep from overwhelming it, and that involves, again, the holistic approach to the system and to the management. And I think you need no further than down the street from where we are right now to see ways in which that's being done extremely successfully. And if some of those things were being applied in Indonesia, then they would be getting the same kinds of yields as they're getting here.
Thank you. Devin? And after that.
I'd also like to congratulate Greg and the panel. It was a really very interesting talk. Thanks a lot. I wanted to make a comment about the issue of transgenics. It's a quite emotive and emotional issue. And I'd just like to point out that the domestication and development process is going to change the animals that we're growing in aquaculture. And that transgenics is just one of many technologies that we use to increase production and profitability. And some of the changes are risky, and some of the changes are less risky. So my comment is that a group of experts on genetics and policy got together and were trying to promote the idea that when you're looking at these changes, really look at the changes and don't focus so much on whether it was traditional animal breeding, genetic engineering, hybridization, or just simply moving a fish out of its native area. You know, you really have to look at the changes that you're going to impart and the environments that that fish can potentially invade and cause damage. If there's uncertainty, then FAO has taken some efforts to define a precautionary approach that helps you deal with uncertainty. And with this kind of information, we might improve the consumer's knowledge and perhaps acceptance of not only transgenic technology, but a lot of the new technologies that aquaculture may use. And so that's my comment, and then I guess I would maybe like the panel to give their opinion on how we can educate the consumer to accept these new technologies. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Devin, this was also touched during the first keynote address by Professor Swaminathan about building confidence, political confidence, professional confidence, public confidence, and media confidence. But basically what we are saying is we are positive to that, but still the learned panel members may would like to comment on that or have some reflections on it. It's a very important issue because I think most of you people know that I think the transgenic salmon is going to be introduced into the system in the U.S. So it is an emotional issue for a lot of us, like the BT brinjal. So please.
Not this one. The earlier question, I think the panel didn't understand the question. Question is the Indonesian farmers now do the commercial tilapia shrimp culture. The stocking density can be manipulated, therefore the tilapia is not going to eat considerable amount of shrimp feed. Therefore, and also they believe that reduced the disease incidence. His question was whether we have done any work. There's no work has been done on the disease resistant, but work has been done in AIT how to manage the stocking density of tilapia and the shrimp, not to get the shrimp tilapia to eat feed. There are, if your Winlet is around here, Winlet company, they also promote that the same method and claim they are, there's no any yellowhead or white diseases in shrimp. Thank you.
Thank you, Amara. But let us go back to that particular thing. I think there may be one or two people who would like to comment on that.
Yeah, in answer to the question, I completely agree. It's an education aspect, but one concern I have is that with the transgenics or the GMOs, so much of the public has just been scared away from it that I fear that even if we get some governmental approvals for some of these GMOs or transgenics, the market demand is going to be so slight that they're going to have a very difficult time making an economically profitable operation out of it. Even if the technology is good and everything, I think the well has been spoiled with the general public already. Now, it may take some time. I mean, in the United States, we eat a lot of GM corn and soybeans and things, but most of the public doesn't even realize it. It's just been very quietly done, and there have been no really ill effects environmentally, socially, health-wise. So, you know, maybe some of these things will happen sooner in other countries that are more accepting than it is in the EU or the US. And then maybe they'll catch on there, and then after quite a few years of people eating it, not having any problems, not having any environmental problems, then it may get accepted into the other countries. But that's my opinion anyway.
Thanks. I've got a similar but slightly different perspective. There's been a number of studies done looking at the perceptions around GM organisms as well, and there's quite a difference in the perception of the use of genetically engineered plants versus animals versus medicines, and there's quite a difference in the acceptance of use of GM approaches for medicines versus plants versus animals, and there seems to be more perception of risk associated with the consumption of GM animals than there does with plants or the use of GM techniques for medicines. And one suggestion, reflection I might offer is that it's probably even more than just education. It's going to be more, I think, a discussion around the areas of risk communication in terms of trying to have a discussion around what are the concerns about the public, what are their perceptions about the risks of the use of GM organisms, and engaging in a discussion around those perceptions more so than the education about what is this technology and what does it mean. And I think when we change the discussion and around to focus more on where people's concerns are, then I think we'll be getting closer to be having a more informed discussion and debate around the use of these organisms. So in the short term, I agree with Kevin in that it's probably be a while before we're able to have that type of discussion, and I see a much more pragmatic approach in using sort of the traditional breeding and starting to introduce, in conjunction with traditional breeding, some of the new technologies as a way of how we're going to progress into the future, rather than sort of jumping in with 2 feet, so to speak, and using these technologies and realizing those benefits in the short term.
Thank you. Going by the response from the audience about transgenics compared to 20 years ago or 10 years ago, I mean, if you just mention the word transgenics, I mean, everybody would go on the chair and start dancing, basically. But today, the response has not been so much. I think people have started to realize that there is the future for it, and I think the acceptance is I think it's getting accepted. It's just a matter of time. You, sir. Is it on transgenics?
Transgenics again, yes.
Okay.
My name is Reinhold Hanep. I'm from Germany, from the Federal Research Institute of Fisheries Ecology, and I have a different perception, actually, towards it. And I think that the European side, especially from the consumer side, is very, very different from what you're actually telling us. I think that that just simply educate the consumer to accept transgenics is far away from the public perception in Europe. So the people are really aware of the risk And I'm sure that a group of geneticists cannot actually evaluate the possible effect of transgenics on nature. So it's an oversimplification just to tell, let a group of geneticists sit together with the governments and try to figure out how to educate people to accept transgenics. That's really far, far, far away from reality. And I give you an example. Even there was a proposal on restocking of sea farming, of sea ranging, a sea ranging program of cod in the Baltic Sea, and the ICES, the International Council of the Exploration of the Sea, actually refused to accept this because of the risk of genetic modification of the natural stock. So even sea ranging with a possible effect on the released fish was seen as too much a risk for the natural population, and this is far away from genetically modified organisms and something like this. So maybe you
thank you, sir. Thank you very much. A quick response to that. I think this older.
I think that that your comment really sort of circles back to what Devin said, and I think it's very important that we separate the perceptions from a rigorous risk management analysis and a risk assessment analysis and risk management approach. And, you know, whether it be a fish that you're releasing to the wild to supplement a natural population, or whether it be a transgenic fish, or whether it be an exotic species, a gift tilapia that you want to move to a different place, you still have the risk assessment and risk management process that you should go through. And once it's put into a more managed process, then it's something that you can actually make a scientifically based recommendation to policymakers. On the other hand, it still goes to the policymakers, and no one's going to force anyone to do anything that they don't want to do, or that they're not going to buy anything that they don't want to buy. The important thing is to be able to have the scientific information on which policymakers can base decisions based on the populations in their countries.
Thank you. You, sir.
Myself, Dhirendra Thakur from AIT. Congratulations to Greg for excellent presentation. You have made a point in conclusion that there are innovations available in terms of sustainability and profitability, but mostly in the domain of the industrial aquaculture. My question is to Greg that, being in private sector, how you see the role of private sector in facilitating all the access of technology or innovation to the small scale farmer in near future or coming 10 years? Thank you.
Excellent point.
It's somewhat complicated. When in the private sector you come up with technological innovations, you want to apply them in an area where you'll be able to sell them. And the question is, you know, I mean, honestly, can you sell more faster to marine harvest, or can you sell to 1,000 small-scale farmers in a remote area of Bangladesh or India? The answer is, you know, you can develop a technology that's applicable for marine harvest, but that same technology that's going to make a fish stronger and healthier is probably applicable also in Bangladesh. So if you're an advanced thinking company, then you're going to think about doing technologies that have the broadest application. And then the trick is to try and get it registered in all these different places and get it sold to all these people, but that's another story.
A lady was here, somebody was? Yeah, please.
Fatima, UPM, Malaysia. I just want to go back to the transgenic fish. We have so much problems with the risk and acceptability of the product, the fish. So I would like to make just a small recommendation. Why not we use this transgenic fish to create other value-added products? For example, pharmaceutical products, nutraceutical products. I mean, they don't have to see the fish, like a big, giant fish to eat. Thank you very much.
You, sir. No, there was one from there at the end. Yeah.
Yeah, also on the genetically modified Aqua Bounty product, I think, as Devin pointed out, the FAO has a policy in place that when there is a lack of scientific certainty, we should err on the side of precaution. And I think one of the problems that I see in with this process in the U.S. is that it's being regulated as a drug by the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, rather than as an animal by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And I think what we see in looking at this particular scenario is that there's sort of a a breakdown here on information available to the public because it's being in regulated or considered to be regulated as a drug. We're keeping some of this proprietary information secret from the public. And there's been 11, 14 something years of research on this animal, but only about 3 weeks of public review on all these documents. And even the FDA's medical committee has said, you know, we can't really understand what are the differences between conventionally farmed salmon and this transgenic salmon. So I wonder if you, any of you, particularly the American contingency here, if you have any recommendations for how this process, if we do want to see these technical innovations in biotechnology go forward, how would we change this coordinated framework in order to maybe make information more available to the public and actually do the safety test to ensure, is this a similar product or not?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there any more questions on transgenics? Is it on transgenics again? Yes. Please, quickly. Crisp question, please.
In Europe, we had a bull that produced very good medicine. It was a transgenic bull, the first one. And it was a very good medicine that you can't produce cheaper in industry that but with this bull. He was in Holland somewhere. But we had to kill him because the transgenic stuff was not accepted, even not to produce a medicine. And I think Europe has not evolved in this matter. Transgenics is the risk, you can't estimate it. Once it gets released in the nature, you don't know what happens with it. And we as scientists, I think, you need to have an ethical and a moral obligation to consider this and not just go about the law and do it under another law to have it accepted. Because no scientist can foresee the risk when this animal gets into nature.
Thank you, sir. Any more? What I will do is I'll just ask one of the panel members to respond to that and FAO to also give the response to that. I think it will be almost on the similar lines. Please, one of the panel members would like to talk on a final word on transgenics? Not really final word, final word for the session. Or Devin? Yes. Okay, there's a transgenic session. Thank you very much. There's a transgenic session. Please, all of you are invited.
Genetics session.
Now, there is a genetic session. So, please, now that is more on access of resources rather than transgenics. You're avoiding the question. No. any new? There in the back, please. Is it on transgenics? Ah, good. You can come forward.
If you don't mind, I would like to ask a more general question. My name is Stamatis Varsamos. I work for the European Union, which is, in a way, the executive body of the European Union. In particular, I work in the service, which is catering for research, is the DG Research and Innovation. And we have a lot of projects which actually are trying to support technological development in all the fields that you have mentioned in your very fascinating talk. However, we have a concern. I make a bracket here to say that there will be a session dedicated to the 7th Framework Program, which is the main instrument for implementing actions in research in the European Commission. And I come back now to my question, which is that we have realized that going from research to application is not straightforward. And I think that in any kind of strategy which involves research initiatives and funding of research, there must be a commitment and actions and measurable objectives for making sure that there is efficient transfer of knowledge which is generated through research to applications. And I would like to have your views on that. Thank you.
To the general questions. You were involved in the GIFT. Genetically improved from tilapia.
Yeah, okay.
Where is
selective
it?
Bread.
Yes. Thing is, we have been talking about this, improvements in genetics, and still a lot of people are using methyl testosterone. Yeah? Okay.
It's for a different
purpose. No, what I'm saying is that there is a gap between what is generally available and what is available to the farmer in terms of science.
No, Sachi, this is a genetic improvement for growth performance.
Yeah, exactly.
That is
no,
sex reversal.
This is same thing in terms of growth improvement. We have Jayanti, which has been made, and similar stories. We have a number of them. What we have done in terms of transgenic, we do a lot of research in this. I've been following very closely what Devlin has been doing in Aqua Bounty and all that. Now, we are talking about the resources. What we have done is because we have the technology to introduce a particular type is for increasing growth. Is it increasing efficiency of production? Which I have been following very closely, and it's not the case. That means resource allocation. How efficient are we? There are traces where I have done analysis of this, how efficient this can be because of short duration of growth. So this is something which is another story. There are issues in terms of other kinds of possibilities. I am coming back to, again, the resources. Swaminathan was mentioning yesterday about nutrients. Okay, fish. What there are limitations in the number of fish metabolic capacities. Are we working on that? These are challenges in terms of transgenics in the future.
Are you saying that transgenics as a tool can be used for these kind of answers? Or?
This is what I had written a number of years back, and there's very little application. What we are doing is right now is simply transferring some of the things which is just from growth, not in terms of efficiency and other things. These are issues that have to be talked about when you are talking about, and then again the question comes how far this is going to be easily available to the poor farmer. This is what you're talking about in the FAO conference, like here.
Thank you very much. Any quick response to that? The question is about how, where do you use these tools and where it will be access is the situation for small-scale farmers.
Yeah, I think both questions had to do with the translation of research into application, and I think you brought up an especially good point that there's a lot of stuff out there that's already been developed and that's already on the shelf that's not being applied. They're tremendous, even in resource utilization. There's so many improvements and huge improvements that could be made in resource utilization just by having a little bit more effective management, just by getting your feed conversion ratio down a little bit. So it would be a disservice if we spent all our time talking about things like transgenics and talking about whiz-bang technologies if we lose sight of the fact that there's a lot of technologies out there that aren't being transferred and that we don't talk about as a recommendation. How do we get the things down off the shelf and out of the ivory towers and into the farms? And I think it's a very good point.
Thank you. If there are last question.
Yeah. I am Rahim Peyghan from Sheikh Chamran University, Iran. I have a question about the limitation factors in transgenic fish. I think there is 3 points that should be considered. One is the fish diversity. I think it is the limited factor in producing the fish that can use for many countries. And the second factor that is the diseases risks in the fish. When you speak about the fish diversity, you only think about the growth of fish. But is the fish is more resistant to diseases or less? It is also important. And the three limiting factor, the third is the fish meat quality. Is it become better or no? If possible, a reply to this. Thank you.
Thank you.
I only comment on how this technology can be accessible for small farmers. I think this is important that this capacity, each country capacity and system as well as policy of the government, for example, in Vietnam, the government strongly support extension, and extension has had to find the way how to help poor farmer to bring this new technology to them. And this is government policy. And then, in terms of system, they make very strong system. Say, extension workers work at even village level to help them. So this many things can be helpful to poor farmer, but depend on how your capacity and how is policy.
Thank you very much. I think I see people moving out of the hall. But I think we had a very good discussion. Thank you very much. On behalf of the organizers, once again, I would like to thank the panel leader, Dr. Browdy and his panel members for an excellent presentation. And I think we will be getting some three or four recommendations for the organizers, please, because this will be very useful. Thank you very much.